Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast. And this is a new podcast series, an occasional podcast series that I'm kicking off with Dr. Simon Lord. My name is Toby Webb. I'm founder of Innovation Forum. Simon and I have known each other for a long time and always had fascinating conversations, whether that be at conferences on stage or over a glass of wine. At the moment, we're stuck on Zoom. So Simon and I thought, let's use the time and let's create a podcast series, which will be out, we think, quarterly. We're going to call it Unintended Consequences, because those are two words which are absolutely key in sustainability. You've got to get your thinking right, because the law of unintended consequences in whatever you do can kick in and cause problems. So that's our objective. Welcome to the podcast, Simon. How are you doing today?
Oh, well, pretty good. I'm in England and a bit of an overcast day, but we're certainly seeing spring in the air, and I'm fortunate to live near the Forest of Dean. So I'm actually seeing all of the trees beginning to bud and start, actually, even some of them beginning to open a little bit in terms of early flowering.
Well, that's a good segue into the first edition of our Unintended Consequences podcast, because we were going to have a chat about tree planting and forests. Yep. Those of you who don't know Simon CV, you can Google Dr. Simon Lord, but he's worked a lot in agribusiness for many, many years. So we're not going to go into detailed CVs, but Simon and I wanted to have a chat about tree planting. I've been getting a lot of emails recently from companies talking about either their tree planting programs, their plans to plant trees, or a service they're offering to sell me and my customers on tree planting in this year of climate change policy. So clearly, tree planting is taking an enormous amount of shape in terms of interest. But of course, there are different ways of doing it. And you can have bad forestry projects and you can have good ones. Simon, let's talk briefly about, I suppose, about the drivers for this. One of the reasons everyone wants to plant trees at the moment is clearly because of climate change. But we've got to be quite careful, haven't we, in how we do this? Because not all forests and plantations and tree planting projects are created equal, are they?
Certainly not equal. And, you know, I think just because of climate change isn't just the other driver. The other one is loss of biodiversity. And if you start looking at biodiversity, then there has to be a habitat to actually preserve those species. And so I think that the other driver is a restitution to this planet, in which we restore the forests as part of the rich biodiversity in the world. And I think those two are the big drivers for what we've been going through.
Yes, certainly true. It's definitely a year of nature and biodiversity.
Well, that and rewilding, isn't it, Toby? I mean, certainly in the UK, people are talking about rewilding. Because we've gone through COVID, I know there's a great deal of chatter on social media about whether or not rewilding and the fact of loss of loved ones can be combined, and so that people plant a tree for every person who has actually been lost due to COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, trees attract, you know, they're an emotional subject. People feel very strongly about them. But from a corporate point of view, Simon, if a company comes to you and says, we're not sure about some offsetting projects for one reason or another, but tree planting sounds good to us. And we've got this carbon footprint and we've done our scope one, scope two, and we do need to do some offsets. So tree planting sounds pretty good. Where should we look? What do we do first? What would your advice be?
Well, first of all, I would tell them you've come to the wrong company. You know, I no longer work for corporates anymore. I'm independent. But when I was CSO of Sime Darby, it's a plantation company. Plantation companies still haven't got their heads around is the fact that, in a sense, they're also land management companies, and they have a huge amount of land available. A company that came to me offering to plant trees on our behalf, we would probably turn down. And the simple reason would be that we have our own tree planting programs, or we did when I was there have our own tree planting programs, because we own some of the land. And therefore, we can actually afford to do it. A lot of these people that come and actually say, well, we can plant trees on behalf, and that way you can offset. And they've done the calculations, and you know, X number of trees equals so many tons of CO2 equivalents. You know, your first questions are, where is it? You know, what type of trees are you planting? Is it a mixture? Are they endemic? Are they native species? Or is it some kind of monoculture that they're actually going to be setting up? The next thing is how are you going to go about it? It's not easy, actually, creating a forest. We've all done a little bit of gardening. We've all done a little bit of planting. And the tree planting is not quite the same. It's not difficult. It's not rocket science. But if you're actually creating a forest, then that's an entirely different thing. You have to get the mixture right, you know, the composition of the forest. Nature does it brilliantly on its own. If you're going to do actually a human-made one, then you actually have to try and mimic that as far as possible. I mean, we've got quite a bit of experience of riparian or buffer zone expansion near rivers, widening them, making them into corridors. Served a slightly different function than to actually trap carbon, although, of course, they're going to do that. This was for a wildlife movement and also, indeed, for physical protection of riverbanks and the land beyond it. You know, some of the lessons learned there is that, first of all, it's quite easy to plant trees. It's another matter to maintain them. And so my other question to a company would be, all right, well, what are your plans once you've built? How are you actually going to maintain it? You know, what kind of effort, what kind of budget is there put aside for basically forest management? What we learned was that just taking native species, you know, essential really, and creating these buffer zones, what we needed to do was plant, first of all, pioneer species that would provide the shade, because most of the endemic species actually needed the shade cover in order for them to start flourishing. And the other problem is that because the land is often being cleared, and you're clearing it and you're actually planting from scratch, is that all these invasive species, which normally would be under control in a balanced ecosystem within a forest, they actually need to be dealt with. And if you're going for a pesticide-free or herbicide-free approach, then the only way that you can do that is actually manual labour and to physically remove climbers and the weeds that compete with these young saplings. But we did in Sabah with the Sime Darby Foundation, it's called Yayasan Sime Darby. We built 5,400 hectare forest from scratch. All palm planters know how to plant trees, and sadly, we always plant them in straight lines. And indeed, that was the approach that we did for the forest. Planting them in a random way actually is not very productive and takes about 12 times as long to do. So we had these rentices in which the trees would be planted. Now we worked out the spacing, optimized, taking advice. It's about 2 meter by 2 meter. So you're essentially planting a tree in a 2 meter by 2 meter quadrant, a little square, and you want to get a composition mix in that area. And you're looking at somewhere about 25 species. And you're wanting to get a stocking density. And it varies, but somewhere between 600 to 1,000 trees per hectare. And we've worked out the cost of doing that. We tried it at 2,000 trees per hectare, which was a bit dense. But it was needed because in the early stages, you know, we weren't very good at this. And so there was actually mortality. You know, that's something, the attrition rate. You learn by doing this. And then with Wetlands International and a great guy called Basil Parrish, we worked with them and they were restoring a peat zone, which is on the edge of one of the biggest forests. And it was just very small areas, but also learned a lot in how to basically recolonize these peat areas. And again, they chose rentices, these straight lines, to get the trees, first of all, established. Later on, nature will do its own job and infill. But again, they had huge problems, not from what you would expect, but actually from local people, and I think egged on by some local councillors, politicians, who urged the people, because there were counterclaims on this land, although it was NGO land, and they actually kept on going in and burning down the young seedlings. And I remember Sime Darby used to have to send its own fire brigade to help them, because it wasn't our project, we were just involved in it, to keep putting out these fires before they could finally get established. There was complete start from beginning, plant these trees. In other areas, they were planting trees at irregular intervals to allow natural encroachment and build that. In other areas, we planted 1.3 million trees now, all of which are endemic to various states in Malaysia. And these are on parcels of land, which for one reason or another, thank goodness, were never planted with oil palm. There's tremendous areas available even in a country like Malaysia, where infilling and tree planting can occur, let alone when you start talking about the temperate areas and the green spaces in the UK, where I live, where you can do it.
So do we talk about tree planting? Because it sounds very simple, because forest restoration is so difficult. I mean, I went to a forest restoration project in Sumatra just before COVID happened. I was blown away by the complexity of it. It's not something I thought about much, but visiting the nursery, and I've got some video of this, listeners, which I'll post for you to see underneath the podcast or somewhere in the notes. You know, you look at the number of species you have available to you to try and put in, and it's literally square meter by square meter on the edge of this seriously degraded forest, which had been degraded over the last century or so. And it struck me it was an unbelievably complex and painstaking process where you've got to make some very difficult choices about which species you might favour over others. Is that why we talk about tree planting? Because forest restoration is so damn difficult.
Yeah, I think it is. And also, you know, dare I say, it's shades of green, isn't it? 50 shades of green when you start doing forest planting. People do it for lots of reasons. But like any forest or any tree planting starts with good nursery management. And the best people to select the species are local people, communities. I know that Eric Wacker in Aid Environment is working very hard in Indonesia on community forests. And I know that the work that Syme did with Nestle's on these restoration of these buffer zones, I mean, basically, Syme Darby had bought a plantation and with it the liability that the earlier owners planted right up to the edge of a river, which is a no-no under the RSPO, but also a no-no when you think about it in common sense. So it began this program of restoring along with Nestle. And there we engaged with the local communities, and particularly the women's group, who seemed to have better green fingers than the men. And essentially they would gather the seeds from the surrounding forests after the infrastructure was put in. They would manage and maintain the nursery because, I mean, rubbish in, rubbish out, not being afraid to cull at the nursery level if something doesn't look perfect, pays off in the long run. I mean, it works with oil palm and it works with most tree species. You know, you plant something that's in poor health, you know, if you go to any garden centre, you know, you don't pick something that looks a little bit poorly and expect it to flourish. It's not animal rescue. It's actually planting trees. So people talk about planting trees because at every step in the process for forest restoration, it is complicated. And I'm not sure it's complex, Toby, but it's a complicated and it's process-driven, it's rate-driven. But when you put it all together, there's a lot of moving parts that need to be made to work. Whereas tree planting is sexy. You go and you plant a tree. I mean, I've got trees all around the world with my name on them, particular inaugural programs that people have set up. And it's fairly easy to plant a tree and anybody can do it and kids can get involved, schools can get involved. It's a great way of rewilding. But when you start talking about a forest, the aftermath of it, it's not just planting it, it's keeping it under control.
So from a corporate point of view, obviously if a big company wants to plant trees, they're not going to just plant one or two or put some around the edge of a school field. And I appreciate that can be a good thing. But surely tree planting monocultures is a bad idea. I mean, we heard examples, the Chinese have tried to do this, haven't they, to stop the expansion of the Gobi Desert southwards. I mean, there are some serious unintended consequences to just sticking a load of sort of monoculture species next to each other and hoping that's going to be an effective program.
It is. I mean, I get the point of tree plantations as a commercial crop because people still want to use wood. I totally understand that, even if you're going for renewable energy sources. You need wood chip. You know, I get that. And they should be regarded like any other crop as an agribusiness and an area of monoculture. I mean, we don't kick up a fuss over a field of cabbage. We shouldn't kick up a fuss over a field of acacia. If you're trying to then claim that you're planting a forest, you're not. You're actually planting a commercial crop. It might have a slightly longer payback, but it's still a commercial crop. Interplanting with a range of species is rewilding, and that's what you're trying to aim.
It's very important then to be clear about what your intention is, because acacia or eucalyptus plantations, if that land isn't going to be used effectively in any other way, they can be a very helpful way of funding restoration elsewhere. I've seen that with April's projects in Sumatra.
Yeah,
some NGOs are sort of whatever, are controversial. But actually, when I saw that land, if that land wasn't used to generate money to save the bits of natural forest that are remaining, it would go to waste and the peat would oxidize and there'd be huge problems. I can see the value for companies in having, you know, plantations that are used and the resources are used for something else. I suppose if you're a corporate and you're thinking about offsetting, you just really want to make sure it's about forestry and rehabilitation than about funding a planting of a monoculture species, which may not actually have a commercial value to it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is about being pragmatic, isn't it, in terms of a monoculture forest that then pays for extra work elsewhere, which otherwise wouldn't be funded. Is that really right? In oil palm, for example, nobody plants on steep slopes, or at least they shouldn't, but they have. Those areas are now available to be regenerated. I wouldn't consider those areas purely as potential revenue source of a monoculture. Yeah, things like balsa, you know, fast-growing, highly prized, paulinia, which is a tree species that is used an awful lot in commercial, and it's fast-growing. Yes, they may well stabilize hillsides and they may well stop it from eroding, because if it was clear, it would just erode and you'd lose the soil fertility. And we don't talk enough about that. Maybe one of our next podcasts will be on soil quality and quantity. Those areas really could be put back to what we would call climax vegetation, you know, or at least putting the seeds in for climax vegetation to be re-established. And I don't think they should be seen as a land grab. In the oil palm industry, and it's no different in other industries, climate change is going to have an impact on the business and on the land. Some of those impacts will be that land that previously was productive is no longer productive. And I think in my industry that I've worked in, people really have to get their heads around the fact that peat is not sustainable and that really we have an exit strategy from those areas which are peat, regardless of the depth. That is land which would be considered as a stranded asset and non-productive. That's an area of land that you can begin to restore. In restoring it, I don't see anything wrong. And in talking to the experts, and I'm not an expert on any strength, is that there can be some small commercial crops which work with the community that give them cash to keep the project running, because it's got to be kept running. But then there are vast areas which can be given over to climax. Steep slopes are natural stranded assets. I mean, you know, water doesn't travel uphill, at least it doesn't in my industry. And therefore, as things get drier, then it's going to affect the slopes even more. It's just fairly common sense. But there are other areas where you're not going to be able to access them because they're waterlogged because of, you know, increased precipitation and porosity. You won't be able to get into those areas, or you won't be able to get into those areas because the road network is being affected, the infrastructure. But all of these are parts of stranded assets, let alone legislation that says, you know, you shouldn't take these areas. And these are great opportunities, which I think people haven't really considered, probably, is looking at regenerative agriculture and combining production and protection. Those areas, we're still going to need food. The big challenge is to grow more food on less land. He said this. It's not me that's saying this at all.
Yeah.
But there's a great opportunity for that land that you're not using to actually go and rewild it. And at the same time, if you can get some kind of carbon value for what that naturally is storing, then that just provides the pump priming money for further expansion of those areas. But we haven't got it right yet, have we?
So what we're saying is that the unintended consequence of just thinking about tree planting is that you can end up with monocultures, you can end up with a badly planned project. What you really should think about is not tree planting, but forest restoration, rewilding and regenerative agriculture projects. Now, they can be kind of insetting projects, I suppose, in a corporate supply chain, or they could be projects that you fund perhaps through engagement with Red Plus program or elsewhere. You mentioned earlier, Simon, the Forest Conservation Fund and their sort of price per hectare. Tell us a bit about that. Is that a potential solution to help cut through some of the confusion about tree planting and its potential unintended?
Yeah, I joined the Earthworm Foundation Forest Conservation Fund in June of last year. It's a very, very simple idea. People can work with earthworm. They will actually find the pieces of land. They will actually do all the paperwork, the legalities, the stakeholder engagement so that communities are involved with it. Because, you know, there is no unencumbered land, Toby, anymore in the world, especially where these forests are. They will put in a system for every single hectare that it is protected. And all that people have to do is donate. And it's $20 per hectare per year. Now, individuals can sponsor this. Corporates, of course, are involved. There's a due diligence process because there has to be in order that it's not just anybody. For example, a company that is trashing the forest in one part of the world can't just buy into this fund to pay for their sins. I mean, they should be doing something themselves. But it's open to all. I'm sure after this podcast, you can share some addresses for this. A wonderful group of people. Charlotte Opal is the person who actually is running this program on behalf of Forest Conservation Fund. And it's got numerous projects. There's about six major projects at the moment. Still needs some more funding. There's no shortage of finding these areas. It's finding the commitments for people to not just buy it for a year, but of course make a longer term commitment. And corporates could play a fantastic role.
Potential solution then. I mean, I think what we tried to do in this initial podcast, and by the way, listeners, we didn't really plan this. Simon and I felt that we know each other well enough to just have a conversation. But I think we appreciate we don't know all the answers. But what we tried to do here is point out that it's a lot more complex than just planting trees and that there are unintended consequences to not thinking it through. And yet there are solutions like the Forest Conservation Fund, which enable you to engage in the longer term and in the kind of wider aspects, which also involve social and community empowerment and kind of rural sustainable development, as well as just planting trees. I hope that's been helpful for some of you. I'm going to post this with some links from Simon and I. And I imagine when we put this on LinkedIn, Simon, with the right title, we're going to get a dozen forestry experts chiming in with their views, which is great, because then we can have that conversation on LinkedIn. But for now, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed the first edition of Unintended Consequences with Simon and Toby. We'll see how the reaction is and we'll see how the podcast series develops. For now, Simon, thanks for your insight.
You're welcome. And I really welcome people to wade in where I've been in error. That's fine. At least point it out. But do so is a way forward, because unless we do start restoring forests, in fact, building forests, then I actually think this planet is on a trajectory which is not going to be good for anybody.
Yeah, well, let's hope these projects, carefully thought through and properly resourced, can make a significant contribution to reducing emissions and enhancing rural livelihoods. We've kind of got to make it work, really, haven't we? So we'll leave it there. Simon, thanks again.
Thanks, Toby.